heard it said, it doesn't have to be fun to be fun. With that in mind, join us for an insider's glimpse into all things trekking, safaris, and world adventure. From packing for your Everest base camp trek, to what it felt like for a cancer patient to attempt to summit Kilimanjaro, or visiting a village in the Sacred Valley of Peru. You will be inspired, informed, and ignited to get out there and start adventuring.
Welcome, welcome, welcome everybody to the Type 2 Fun Podcast. My name is Mariah, and today, right before we hit record, I was saying this is actually my favorite kind of podcast. No clue what we're going to end up talking about. Just getting to know an amazing trekker named Meryl. And I think I'm really excited just, you know, to see where it goes and what we learn. And hopefully a couple of amazing Type 2 fun stories. But let's dive on into it. Hey, Meryl, how are you?
Hi, good to hear you.
Yeah, I'm so glad you could join us. And you know, like I was telling you before we hit record, before I dive into your insane roster, that I'm looking at your, hiking profile, I'd love to know, you know, where you live, what do you like to do when you're not trekking, what do you, the quote unquote, the real world, as I like to call it, you know, all that fun stuff.
Sure. Well, first of all, I live on the amazing Olympic Peninsula. It's one of Washington's better kept secrets. And I think a lot of people don't realize that people actually live up here. It's a big tourist destination because obviously Olympic National Park is here. But there's a cute little town called Port Angeles of 20,000 people with the Strait of Juan de Fuca on one side and the Olympic Mountains on the other. And I live right in between.
Wow. Sounds gorgeous.
And I work for, I should say I work for Washington State Parks, but I'm fully remote, which is sort of a weird silver lining of the pandemic that I almost feel guilty saying that, but but it allowed me to go one step further in crafting a life that I love.
Oh, that's amazing. So you weren't doing that before the pandemic?
I was working for Washington State Parks, but we were all based in Olympia, which is the capital of Washington.
Got it. And so now you're able to be at home. I work from home too, just a pajama world. I love it. It's amazing. Well, from the waist down.
I know. We all have those early pandemic stories where we accidentally stood up and
Yeah. See, I was always remote even before it was cool or before the pandemic hit. So I was telling everybody like, welcome to my world, you know? But yeah, for sure. Well, I love that. And so I guess let's dive right on in. Tell me, like, do you remember when you first started trekking, when you heard of it? Like, how did you get into it?
Yeah. I mean, one thing I always find important to say is that I was not a natural born athlete. I was actually born with some ortho and neuro issues that would probably qualify today as disability. And what that looked like back then is I was in the special ed version of PE and we just sort of got written off. But I always loved to move my body. I always loved to be active. I was kind of one of those kids that couldn't sit still. I rode my bike everywhere. I did gymnastics. I was on the monkey bars. And one thing I was just remembering, I think my dad reminded me of this. There's this house in LA called the Hollyhock House, which is this historic Frank Lloyd Wright house. It's, you know, it's very protected. And I remember when I was 10 getting busted for climbing on the roof of it. So I think my whole life, park personnel weren't that happy with my parents. But I think I've always lived a type 2 fun life. In my late teens and early 20s, I began to travel very extensively. I traveled in more than 30 countries before I turned 30, and I was always working in college to get travel money. And then in the aughts, I got hardcore into skydiving, and that to me, that's type one fun. That's not type two fun. You just like, woohoo, let's jump out of a plane. Yeah, let's go. I've made about 1,000 jumps in my life so far. But mountaineering and backcountry travel came about, after my mom died. She had had a 7-year decline, and I was a part-time caregiver at the same time I was working full-time and going to grad school. And I just remember shuttling between Portland and LA with my laptop, my school books, and my parachute. I was always hopeful that I could get a jump in. And I was always, when I wasn't actually doing caregiving or working or in grad school or trying to get a skydive in, I was always walking. And it just helped me. It helped me organize my thoughts. It helped me plan. It helped me calm down during a very stressful period. But I had no idea what hiking was. I remember somebody took me to Punch Bowl Falls, which is in the gorge, and hopefully you'll get to see it when you get out there. And I think it's like 4 miles and 400 feet of elevation gain. And I was throwing up on the side of the trail. I had no idea. I mean, walking down the street is, you know, one thing, but hiking was a completely different thing. So when she passed away, I realized that I wanted to stop gambling away my present on the hope of a bright future. I wanted to be able to live for today, just in case, you know? And so I started saying yes to some things that were way out of my comfort zone. And one of those was climbing Mount St. Helens. And it was a suffer fest. I would say at that time, it felt like type 3 fun. But when I got down, I remember saying to my friends, I'm never doing this again. And then 3 days later, someone said, we're climbing Mount Adams. You want to go? And I'm like, oh, hell yeah. So it ended up, you know, it's really become this huge part of my life out of that. And it's
I think type 2 fun anthem around the world is I'm never doing this again.
And then
they do it
again. And then 3 days later, you're signing up for the next thing.
Yeah. Before we go deep into trekking world, I must have done a horrible job of researching you, because I didn't know you were a skydiver. I am as well.
Oh, so, yay! Where do you jump?
I've not jumped since the pandemic, so shame on me, but I have a few hundred jumps as well. You said 1,000. I only have a few hundred, but I have my B certification. So now I know we have to meet. We have to jump and we have to hike for sure. But I don't know that I'm going to do Mount St. Helens. I don't know that you can grab me into that as my first one with you.
I haven't jumped since the pandemic either. I still have my shoe, my reserves out of date. And I'm like, I got to either get back in the sky or sell this stuff off. But yeah,
I was having the exact same conversation. I said, I have a recurrency jump. I was like, I need to just do it. Or that was a phase of my life that I don't do anymore. And it was fun.
It's a hard thing to part with.
Yeah, it is. It is, because I agree with you. It is 100% type 1 fun and the most peace I've ever found in my entire life. So kind of like what you were talking about, what trekking has brought to you, that is most certainly what skydiving was for me. So I totally agree.
Yeah, trekking is different. It's slow. And you're there for hours. You're out for hours and the views change. I mean, skydiving is just this huge rush. And of course, there's tremendous peace, especially you're on a sunset jump. You pull at 10,000 feet. You float under your parachute for 20 minutes. I mean, there's nothing like that. But when you're out for hours and hours and you're just plodding along and the scenery is changing, or you're just in a forest or you're in an alpine meadow, and there's a lot of room to just meditate or think or be.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So it sounds like, other than, you know, your introduction into hiking was pretty, it sounds brutal, that you connected to that piece, PEACE, that you just couldn't let go of, it sounds like.
It was a way to move my body and bring my mind into sync.
Mm-hmm.
And at that moment, it was a way to work through grief.
Yeah.
And have some time to plan my next moves, if you will. I mean, when you spend 7 years in grad school working full time and being a caregiver, and then, you know, and then all that goes away, it's there's a big what's next. And I needed those hours to just walk and climb and scramble and think and let answers come. And
yeah,
I think that's where trekking really got me. It was kind of like therapy in a way.
Yeah. And it sounds like it just snowballed into a huge chunk of your identity as well, which is awesome.
Yeah, I never thought that my identity would be something athletic. But there it is.
Yep.
But hiking actually gave me health. It kept me fit. It kept my body in motion. And when you've seen someone decline for 7 years and lose mobility and lose their health, I think part of it was wanting to do everything possible to give myself every chance to stay healthy into middle age and into old age.
Yeah. And so did this end up being your main form of physical exertion, I guess? Or did it, you know, spiral into, well, I'm also going to do this and I'm also going to do this? Or did, you know, this, you just latch on with both hands?
I think there's a certain amount of training that you need to do some of the things that I do. And so I picked up other physical training regimens along the way. So I do strength training. I do aerobics classes. I do a little bit of running. I do some biking. I'm a paddle boarder. But most of the focus is to be fit for the mountains.
Right. What do you find is the extracurricular activity you didn't think would help you the most in trekking?
Oh, wow. That's a really good question. I would say strength training and core training.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think of lifting weights or doing functional rotation or a bunch of sit-ups as being something that would help me in mountaineering. But that and balance exercises have saved me, probably have actually saved me a couple times. I heard one mountain guide that I knew used to say, your fitness is you get more dance steps before you fall.
Yeah.
And so I can tell you how many times I have almost tripped or I have almost fallen or I've almost lost my balance. And when I look back, I think the strength training and core training and balance has really helped. And it was surprising.
So you spoke about balance training, like you actually work on your balance. Is that like a regimen or is it just your, you know, to my head, you're like, you're standing on one foot on a beam.
It's part of some of the classes I do. I sort of do like these old lady classes. It's fun. I started doing them on Zoom through my gym when I had done them in person with my gym. And then I started doing them on Zoom. And even though I moved, I still do those classes on Zoom. And, you know, I call them my old lady exercise classes, because a lot of it is just, you know, tree pose or, you know, airplane or just things that are going to help with balance, or rotational exercises with a stretch band or a weight.
Yeah. For me, it was definitely, it's a form of Pilates that but in essence, it's still, they call it a reformer, and that reformer machine, and it works those same muscles you're talking about, those core muscles, those, and even underneath it by your hip flexors, these tiny, tiny muscles you never even knew you had. And you're moving like so small, but you're putting so much tension in there. And you wouldn't believe how much that helps you. Although I'm super clumsy in general, but definitely on the trail. So I'd hate to think where I'd be without it, but it sounds like your stuff is definitely, you agree, it's kind of potentially saved your life.
Well, that, and you know, you never know, you never realize how important those muscles are until you pull one.
Right. So true.
There's this little muscle and ow, that really hurts. But I think also the functional rotation is big in terms of just even getting a giant backpack on.
Yeah, for sure. So, do you have all of your treks been someone else? Like, are you spending the night out there? Do you have a Sherpa, or is it just day hikes? Like, you know, you just said how, you know, carrying a big pack, you know, anything that's been super long for me, I've had a Sherpa, and everything I've done on my own has been, you know, a day hike. So I'm just taking, you know, food and emergency stuff. But what's predominantly your world like out there?
Generally, the treks I've been on, you carry about a 15-pound pack, and your porters carry 16 kilos or 32 pounds. And so they're carrying your overnight pack, and you're carrying your personal gear. I just went to Peru in 2022, and we did the Asangate trek, and we were carrying more on that one. I think I carried about 25 pounds until we hit about 16,000 feet, and then I'm like,
Could this go on a donkey? Thanks.
but I usually domestically when I'm leading for the mountaineers or backpacking with my friends, then we're completely self-contained. But when I go international, I hire guides and Sherpas. It's very important to me, first of all, to get to know the culture. I mean, to hear stories, to have evenings in the lodges or in camp with your guides and your porters, and get to know them and talk about their families and what have you, and also to support the local economy. I mean, I'm in a pretty privileged place where I can spend money on treks, so could probably maybe negotiate some discounts to carry more stuff, but I also want to be able to support the local people. And at the same time, I don't want to be colonialistic, if it as it were. Like if they wanted me to carry my own stuff, I would feel like I need to be prepared to do that, even at 16, 17,000 feet. But if it's going to help them, then I'm going to let them do that heavy lifting.
All right, so you get into trekking. It's, you know, mental and physical stimulation. It's permeated who you are. All right, so tell me some of the major ones that you've done. You know, again, I'm looking at your list. So tell the audience, because I definitely know, or the listeners, I'm looking at your list. But you know, did you make a list and you're going, you know, you're just going, oh, I'm gonna do this and this and this, or did it just take on a life of its own? And you know, tell me about some of these big ones that left an impact.
It was sort of a what's next, what's next, what's next year after year. So between my mom's death and St. Helens, I hiked in Iceland, and it was 2010. It was right after Eyjafjallajökull blew up. And if you remember 2010, if anybody in the audience remembers 2010, it shut down most of the airports in Europe for like 3 weeks. And I went 3 months later, and I still remember this 2 mile hike over this ash blackened glacier to this lonely hut, you know, in the middle of nowhere. And I was carrying all my stuff because the chase vehicle did not go that far. And I thought I was going to die. But it was also just the coolest thing. I mean, we were barbecuing in hot spots in the ground. It was fascinating to me. And the light bulb went on that I could combine my love of travel and my love of hiking. And in 2014, I started to think about Kilimanjaro. I started to think about the Seven Summits, actually. I didn't end up pursuing that line of those goals, but I started thinking about Kilimanjaro, and I ended up going in 2015 with a group of nine Mazamas, and you know, we just had so much fun, and it was a chill experience. No one was racing up the mountain. Everyone was just out to have fun. we were all there for the cultural experiences. We were all there for the landscape. I mean, you know from Kilimanjaro that you go through so many ecosystems.
Yeah. Yep.
And each day it's like you're in a different, microclimate, and of course at a different altitude. And we all summited, and we all summited at sunrise, and it was so beautiful. And then of course we had the 10,000 foot trek down, and then we all went on safari, and then we all went to Zanzibar. And I thought, I got to make this a regular part of my life. So, and of course, you know, Kilimanjaro is, again, I'm speaking from a place of privilege of being able to organize and pay for and take the time for a trip like that. But I really made it a commitment to go every couple of years to do a different trek. And that's when I started making my list.
Yeah. I'm counting, and I swear I'm up to 50, right? Like, what's, do you have a number yet?
Oh, of treks?
Yeah.
Oh, probably more like 10.
There's no way. I'm looking here. There's one here. You've done Shasta 5 times by itself.
Well, but that's my personal. I mean, that's me leading for the mountaineers or going with friends.
Right.
That's the 40-pound backpack. there's nobody setting up my camp or making me popcorn. Right. Chocolate when I get to the end of a hard day. That's just, it's hard until that's like type 2.5 fun.
I'm just saying, there's no way there's 10. I'm looking at a lot here. This is a massive accomplishment, which is amazing. I've not even heard of half of these places. I feel like such a poser, but some of these, they even sound fun.
Like what? Which one?
well, the 7 Guatemalan volcanoes. Hello. Whoa.
Embark is doing that, or has been putting that together. And I was listening to one of the podcasts with Donovan talking about the eruption of Fuego, and he was living 10 miles from Fuego, and that you could camp on the side of a Catenango and watch Fuego just blowing up every 10 minutes. And I remember that. I mean, that was one of those.
He sends me that picture every couple of months. He's like, this is your next trek. He's like, just go ahead, sign up for it.
You got to do it.
I know. It sounds amazing. It totally is next on my list for sure.
And the Guatemalan people are wonderful.
Yeah.
There are certain countries where I've been, and I don't want to be a downer because this is a really fun podcast, but the 1996 genocide is still very fresh in the minds of most people in Guatemala. And if they open up to you and talk to you about their lives and their parents and the people they've lost, the culture is so, it's heartbreakingly beautiful. And I really loved Guatemala, and I really loved the people I met there. And I'm still in touch with a couple of my guides, and just enjoy seeing their, you know, seeing their posts on social media and seeing, you know, an occasional email from them, and just knowing that they're okay and that they're thriving it makes me really happy to see that.
You know, I'm sure you would echo this, but every time I go to a country and trek, I always say, I don't think anybody can get any nicer. And I guarantee they don't say that, you know, no one can say that about America when you come trekking here, but their culture, no matter where we are, you know, I've been in, well, you've been here. I'm looking at Nepal, you know, Nepal, Peru, Africa, like it just, I'm even like speechless just saying they're so welcoming. If you go in there with a welcoming heart and they will open up their hearts, their minds, their culture, their soul to you. It's amazing.
It is. And one of the other things I found in trekking internationally has been that these are some of the best climbers and trekkers in the world.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
And they don't get much attention. I mean, it's starting to change, particularly with the Sherpa culture, but so many of these porters and guides, they don't get any of the recognition they deserve. I mean, a Sherpa guide climbs Everest 12 times for every client that climbs Everest.
Yeah.
And, you know, Donovan was talking about Island Peak, and, you know, the Sherpas do the lion's share of the work on those mountains. And then, you know, someone white and Western gets the credit. And I'm glad to see Tenzing Norgay getting more historical recognition. I'm glad to see, you know, some of the famous Sherpas in Washington who lead on Everest for companies like Alpine Ascents are starting to found their own companies and starting to do their own thing and get the recognition they deserve, because they really are some of the best climbers in the world. And you saw on Kilimanjaro, I mean, your porters are climbing with sandals and jeans and egg cartons on top of their heads.
Yeah. And what I loved about it is I'm gasping for air and they're laughing, they're joking, they're singing, they're having a grand old time. And I'm like, and then they tell me, you know, when I get back down, I got to come back up again. I'm like, you're just driving to get coffee. Like, this is your life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is like the biggest thing I've ever done in my life. And you do it every, you know, every 12 days. So, yeah, it's completely insane. Sure. Well, you as a female trekker as well, do you enjoy, the trials and tribulations of being a female out in the wilderness?
Well, it's interesting because I joined the Mazamas in 2012, and that's where I met Donovan. And it was a very different culture back then.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, between ageism, ableism, sexism, I was just like, what am I doing here?
Right.
And I just loved the mountains so much, and I wanted the technical training so bad that I stuck with it. And it's funny because this is a bit of a story. I was in my basic class, and we had this overnight at the Mazama Lodge up on Mount Hood. And our lead instructor, who was a middle-aged male, pulled me aside and said, you know, do you think that you're slow because you're older or because you're female? And I looked at him and I said, now I know why you're in your mid-50s and you live alone with a cat. And I hear this sort of tittering behind me and I sort of ignored it. But then later on, a woman named Amy, who became my mentor in the Mazamas, she just like started laughing. She said, that was a good comeback. And by the way, you want to climb Mount St. Helens on Mother's Day, because you just need to know that this stuff can be fun. And we went and we did the Mother's Day climb, which I'm sure Carrie has told you all about the Mother's Day climb on Mount St. Helens.
Yeah.
It used to be such a huge party. They've started limiting permits, but Amy invited me and there were like 50 Mazamas and, you know, everybody was dressed to the nines and we all climbed Mount St. Helens. And I think that's when I met Carrie in her unicorn onesie. And I was like, you're right, this is really fun. And I went on to do so much climbing with Amy. And she took me up Rainier. She took me up a bunch of different climbs in the Cascades that were technically way above my pay grade and really gave me the confidence to keep going. Mm-hmm. And I think if not for her, I would have quit. Or I just would have been like my own solo hiker and maybe found some friends to hike with. But it wouldn't have become what it has become. I credit Amy with a lot. And she went on to be on the leadership development committee with the Mazamas. And I credit her and a few other really strong women with being the change. The Mazamas is a very different organization than it was 11 years ago. And I'm really proud of where they've come, how far they've come, and also the Mountaineers. I mean, the Mountaineers has a lot of investment now in diversity, equity, inclusion, which includes, you know, more women, more folks of color, more LGBTQ folks, and just trying to make people feel welcome in a space that has historically been advertised as something for white men. So mm-hmm. I experienced it. I think that in the last few years, I mean, I've aged to the point where people aren't necessarily sexualizing me anymore. So I'm not I don't have men interacting with me when I'm leading their climbs in that way. Mm-hmm. They tend to respect me. I'm some of them. I'm their mom's age, so I can put on mom face, and they get nervous and listen to me. And I've also become partnered, and so anybody who was maybe looking at me as a single woman is not looking at me that way anymore. My partner and I lead a lot together, and he's very, very clear that I am the more experienced climber. I was actually one of his mentors. So there's a tremendous mutual respect there when we lead together. But the cultural change has been tremendous, and I am very excited to see more women being recognized for their achievements in the outdoors.
What is it that you think your mentor taught you that made you love it so much? Do you think it was just, not saying asinine things to you, or was there a special formula?
She made it fun. She has a wicked sense of humor, and mm-hmm. so everything was fun. But she knew when to get serious, and we were on Rainier, and the route had blown out coming down. We had taken a route up and it was no longer viable going down. And she was like, okay, listen up, guys, look alive. This is where it gets real.
Mm-hmm.
And she was able to really drum it down to, we need to work together as a team. We need to have each other's backs. We need to be on it with our technical skills. We need to dig deep mentally, because this is getting into type three fun. and she really pulled us through. She also held my hand walking down. Oh my God, what was the mountain? I can't remember. I've blocked it out because it was so miserable. It was just this hard pan over scree. Sand over hard rock. And it was just, I remember sliding down, and I was butt scooting, and I was crying and whimpering. And Amy and her leadership partner, Lynn, just basically actually held my hand. So if you're a leader and you're willing to do all that to ensure your student's success, I mean, there's no way you can go wrong.
Yeah.
It's very high touch, and not everybody has it in them. There have been times when, as a leader, I've had somebody have a complete meltdown on my trip and I had no idea what to do. So it's really, I mean, that was a special gift that Amy and her climbing partner, Lynn, had that really helped me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can't think of a better segue than to hear about some of your type two fun stories, because that one right there sounds like, if you sneeze, it kind of was. It sounded like more type three. I agree. But let's hear some of those really good. I call them bar stories too. And people don't know what type two fun means. I'm like, it's the story you tell at a bar, and everybody goes, whoa, like, you right. know, that crazy story. So I'm sure you have a bajillion, but are any coming to the surface?
Yeah. And what I can say about my type two fun stories is that a lot of them are lessons learned. Mm-hmm. When I get back and I'm telling the story at the bar, on my first drink, I realize that there are lessons to be learned. And I think that's important too, because sometimes when you're really suffering, there's something to gain from that. There's something to get out of it that you bring to the next experience. And one that comes to mind is, I was leading Del Campo, which is up in the North Cascades for the Mountaineers. And a friend of mine was really feeling like her balance was off, and she was tired, and she didn't really want to go. And I was encouraging her, like, oh, come on, you've got this. You've been training all summer, blah, blah, blah. And we get up to this gully, and one of my other leaders, who was a middle-aged male, suggested taking this one route that I sort of knew wasn't the right route, because I had studied the route. And I said, okay, because, he was the middle-aged white male, so he had to know better than I did. I was a very young leader at this time. And my friend was climbing above me and knocked a 200-pound rock down on me. And I ducked at the last minute. I saw it coming. I ducked. It glanced off my backpack. It hit a very small corner of it, hit my helmet, cracked my helmet. And I stood up and I was like, and everyone was like, oh my God, are you okay? I was like, I don't know. So kind of moved to the side. I said, first of all, this is not the right gully. We need to go down and, you know, regroup.
First of all, I was right.
Right. Of course. That's the first thing that came to mind. The second thing that actually the first thing that came to mind is that this this other leader, this white male, middle-aged person who thought he knew best, was not wearing a helmet. So the very first thing I said is, you're going down. You can't be on this route, because if that had been you, we'd be calling for recovery right now.
Yeah.
And so he was very freaked out, and he and my friend who had sent the rock down, they both went and took cover. And I'm like, okay, I'm fine. Let's go to the summit. Let's do it. So five of us went to the summit. It was like this fourth class rock scramble up to this very, very tippy top pinnacle summit. And we came down, and I was like, you know, I was like a little not feeling great. And we got down, and then I got back to my apartment, and one of my mountaineer's mentors lived in the next apartment, and I went over to see him, and he did the Penlight first aid check. And he said, you need to go to urgent care. You have a concussion.
Whoa.
And I did. And so I led this group up to the summit of this fourth class scramble with a concussion, not even aware that I was, you know, that I was injured. And so many lessons came out of that. I mean,
why didn't you go to sleep? Oh my goodness.
It was an interesting, I mean, it was, so many lessons came out of that. I am a better leader because that happened.
Wow.
And
my favorite part is when you sent the man down the mountain.
I sent him to someplace where he'd be safe.
Amazing. You go, leave.
No, more like get yourself. He didn't have his helmet. I'm like, oh my God, you have to go be safe.
You don't have to go home, but you have to leave here.
Yeah. That was a big part of the lesson. It's like, no, I knew the route. Why did I cede my power? Why did I cede my expertise and my leadership to someone just because of his gender or his age?
Yeah. Well, that's a whole different podcast, Meryl.
True.
And a whole different movement. So yeah, no, wow. That one's crazy. Have you ever, in those camping ones, have you ever needed to stay longer because you got lost or, you know, weather or anything like stay, you know?
I have not. We have been weathered off mountains. We have not been able to summit. But I have not had to have an unplanned bivy or I've you know, gotten lost for like an hour, but no, I have not had, thankfully. I mean, I'm sure the day is coming, right? It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, but not so far, so good.
Yeah. Well, I get lost in a wet paper bag. So it is, this I think is a very, poor, hobby for me to have, or definitely never to do alone. So you would not have that problem with me. I would listen to everything you said. And if you know, led me off a cliff, I'd be like, well, she said so. So this must be the route.
Mariah, this is a really, really good point to discuss. There is never a time when a less experienced person should not question something they feel in their gut is wrong.
Right. For sure.
That is, I mean, there's something called the halo effect that people kind of ascribe to leaders. They put a halo on the leader and they think the leader knows everything. And the leader doesn't always know everything, and they're not always right. And even the whole, well, I've been climbing for 15 years and I know what I'm doing, or I've been up this mountain 5 times. If you feel in your gut that something is wrong, you need to stop the party and say, hey, let's discuss this. let's talk about it. Let's see if there are other options, because there are people who have been killed because they did not express something to the leader in a way that would have the leader actually sit up and take notice.
Well, I would even specifically say, now I don't know if I just don't know any better because I am a female and I don't know what it's like to be male, but I do know I've explained women's intuition men before, and they're like, no, we don't have that.
No, they don't.
I would say especially, and there's, I believe I've done some research on some scientific reasons why, honestly, but I would even say, to your caveat, especially females, if you are feeling that feeling that we can't ever deny, or that thought that we can't be quiet, then yeah, you got to listen to that. It's like when the hairs stand up on the back of your neck, like, you know, something's up.
I had an experience like that. I was in the Enchantments, and I had done a through hike, and I was camping at kind of one of these dispersed Forest Service campgrounds, and it was just me. I was meeting my partner at Goat Rocks the next day, so I was going for a really, really big weekend. And I woke up at like 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm ready to go. I'm brushing my teeth in the trunk of my car, you know, and have everything thrown in the back of my car. And suddenly it was like something. I can't even explain it, but the hair stood up on my neck, and a little voice in my head said, go, leave now. And I'm like, just finish brushing my teeth. No, go now. And I'm like, I've got my toothbrush in my mouth, and I'm like getting in my car and like zooming off. I have no idea what it was, whether it was an animal or a human or whether there was nothing, but it didn't matter. I mean, when a gazelle is drinking at the drinking hole,
yeah,
and the hairs stand up on its neck, it does not think. It runs because no. It's about to be dinner.
Wow. Yeah. And because this isn't a movie, this is life. We don't know what that was.
Right.
But wow. But regardless, what I love is your last point was it could have been nothing, but it doesn't matter. You acted on it and you trusted it, because more often than not, it is something. And we need to learn to trust our instincts.
We do. We do. Yeah. And, yeah. You know, instinct is not fact. I mean, but it counts for something.
Yeah, it does.
One of my type two fun stories was I was an assistant leader. You know, I was training to be a leader, and there were four of us, and there were, it was me and three males and a leader, or no, me, two males and a leader who was also male. And we were hiking, we were climbing up Mount Daniels on a glacier, and it was pouring, and all of us were soaked through. There were eight students and the four of us leaders, and it was warm, but I felt like this little tiny bit of wind. And I'm thinking, it's going to be really windy up on that glacier, and we are soaked. And if somebody goes in a crevasse, it's like certain death. And the leader stops everybody and says, well, you know, what do you think we should do? And, you know, the guys are like, oh, well, we could go up that glacier. It's faster. And, you know, oh, we could go like scramble that shoulder. And I look at them and I'm like, or we could just turn around and get out of here. And the leader looked at me and he says, I like Meryl's idea.
Yeah.
And these students who were trying to get their graduation climbs, because the Mountaineers are structured a little different than the Mazamas. You actually have to climb to graduate. Mm-hmm. They were glaring. They were giving me the evil eye. And I was like, I'm standing by it. And we left, and the leader was like, that was the absolute right decision. So sometimes, yeah, being a woman and speaking up in a group of men, especially like real goal oriented type A men who like want to get the goal, get it done, you know, mm-hmm. Get that summit, or students who are so invested in it, you know, they want this climb so they can graduate.
Right.
You've got to stand your ground on stuff like that.
Well, I rather listen to you and have the ability to be mad at you later and get to do it again than, than, you know, I'm in heaven and I'm like, now I can't be mad at her, you know, it's over.
Or you're in the hospital and, you know,
right.
Or somebody you care about on that team.
Yeah.
Is, yeah. Yeah. Hurt. Yeah.
No, I totally agree. I would have said, I'm so glad you could be mad at me right now. Yeah. I'm so glad you're giving me this stink eye. You're welcome. that is insane. Meryl, I feel like I could talk to you forever. And I thank you so much for sharing a little bit of, you know, your story and who you are. And I would love to have you back again. I could have gone 9 different ways with this, you know, podcast with you. And I feel like we need to have all 9 different conversations, again, and, or, you know, on a trek someday for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We should definitely trek someday.
Yeah. 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 And if you decide whether or not you're going to skydive again, then that'll be my answer. I will too. And we'll okay. go get a recurrency.
Dust off our parachute after that pandemic, right?
Yeah. For sure. For sure. I really appreciate it. And we will talk to you soon. Okay.
Thank you so much, Mariah. It's great to talk with you. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely.
Remember, it doesn't have to be fun to be fun. Thank you for joining us on the Type 2 Fun podcast. We will see you next time. But until then, explore our adventures at www.embarkexplorationco.com.